Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truth.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Welcome to Diffusion, the National Science Show. If you like your science fresh, interesting, uncluttered, unprejudiced and relevant, join us for the next half hour and enjoy the sensation of your mind expanding as we pour it into your brain. In this edition, Johnny August will be having a look at the neurology of ethics, and I'll be having a look at seagrasses. We've got a whole bunch of other good sciencey goodness in between. But first up, we have the news with Patrick Ruby.
More news on dark matter. The dark matter that exists in the universe today might have been responsible for the early expansion of the universe. Cosmologists believe that shortly after the Big Bang, the universe went through a period of early expansion, called inflation, but until now have been unsure what caused it. Andrew Little of the University of Sussex, UK, and colleagues believe that a single type of particle caused this inflation and currently exists as what we call dark matter. This particle is named an inflaton and would have strange pressure properties, pushing space apart and forcing it to expand. According to current theory, most inflatons would have collided with normal particles and decayed soon after the expansion, becoming normal particles themselves. But some survived and now form a type of scaffolding for the universe, attracting surrounding matter to them. There is a problem with the accepted theory, however. If inflatons decay when they collide with normal particles, then how come there are still some around? Little proposes a novel answer. Inflatons only decay when colliding with other inflatons. They are widely dispersed in the universe now and are unlikely to collide with each other, but if they did, they could be detected as a burst of high-energy radiation. This new theory is admired by several astronomers in the field, but evidence is needed to support it. Another job for dark matter. New research could provide a vaccine for HIV. The key to fighting HIV could be in its genes. HIV-2, a less common and less virulent form of the virus, only develops into AIDS in 20% of cases. This is because one of its genes, the GAG gene, is recognised by white blood cells in our body, which can then target the gene and destroy the virus. This GAG gene is small, coding for just 18 amino acids, and hardly ever mutates. This makes it a good candidate for developing a vaccine. If a vaccine containing part of the GAG gene were made, it would trigger the body's immune system to develop an effective response to it. The discovery was made by teams of scientists from Oxford University, UK, and the Medical Research Council Unit in Gambia. The more virulent strain of HIV, HIV-1, develops into AIDS in 98% of cases. But in the 2% where it doesn't develop, it is because the immune system has targeted the GAG gene as well. The drawbacks of the research? This vaccine wouldn't prevent infection with HIV, but if successful, it would prevent the development of HIV into AIDS and possibly reduce the ability for the infection to be passed on. Matter and antimatter have come together. The first two-atom positronium molecule has been synthesized, comprising of both matter and antimatter. Standard laws of physics state that for every ordinary matter particle that exists, a corresponding antimatter particle also exists. For positively charged protons, there are negatively charged antiprotons, and for negative electrons, there are positive positrons. When these counterparts come together, they annihilate each other in a flash of energy. However, an antimatter-matter atom is able to exist in theory, such as the hydrogen-like positronium. Physicists at the University of California, Riverside synthesized the two-atom positronium molecule, known as PS2. They trap 20 million positrons and blast them onto a surface of porous silica for a nanosecond. The positrons captured electrons to form positronium atoms. These atoms then paired up to form the PS2s. About 100,000 of them were created before they annihilated themselves. The reason they stayed together for a short period of time was because the silica absorbed excess energy from the atoms, delaying them from flying apart. Antimatter technology is already used in medicine, such as positron emission tomography, or PET scanning, which is used to detect diseases. This new development might also help develop fusion power and energy weapons. Beam me up, Scotty. And finally, loneliness might drive your immune system crazy. A study has shown that isolated or lonely people have different genetic activity in their immune system. Researchers from the University of California, Los Angeles, and the University of Chicago in the US studied the gene of 14 volunteers. 200 of the genes were abnormally expressed in the lonely people. These genes were typically used in making antibodies and responding to tissue damage. Lonely people might have unhealthy levels of chronic inflammation, which is associated with heart disease, arthritis, and Alzheimer's. Many studies have already shown that people describing themselves as lonely are more likely to die prematurely from infections, high blood pressure, insomnia, and cancer. Scientists have been in two minds about what premature death was due to. It could be simply a lack of social support for people with these diseases, or alternatively, loneliness might enhance the biological progression of the disease. If there is a direct biological link, it might be possible to treat these conditions with anti-inflammatory medications. This would reduce the risk of disease, but might also target the feeling of loneliness.
Our resident neurohead, Johnny August, has been talking to Dr. Mark Hauser from Harvard University about the neurology of ethics. Just before we put this on, we need to apologise in advance. This interview recording is of fairly low quality, so you may have to turn your radio up a bit. Our apologies here. It was done in a crowded pub in the middle of the night with lots of alcohol flying, or at least that was Johnny's excuse.
This is an exciting period as the empirical work is just really beginning, only maybe in the last 10 or so years, and is beginning to provide very interesting empirical material for basic people in philosophy to kind of grapple with. I think one of the interesting parallels here is that, you know, 25, 30 years ago, people who were in the philosophy of mind, interested in questions of consciousness, could do their work without ever dealing with any empirical work. Now, serious philosophers of mind have as their basically material the empirical work coming out of the neurosciences and the psychological sciences. The philosophy of morality or philosophy of ethics is, I think, in the same stage the philosophy of mind was 30 or so years ago. Most moral philosophers would never traffic in the empirical world. Now, many moral philosophers, as evidenced by this conference, are beginning to grapple with what the empirical data does in terms of constraining certain theoretical positions within moral philosophy.
One of these empirical studies is the moral sense test, which Mark has initiated, which he now outlines.
The moral sense test is a web-based engine that was originally put together in order to try to collect a very large sample of data from people from all over the world, obviously initially English-speaking, who would provide us with information about who they are, demographic information, their religion, their education, their age, gender, and then proceed to answer a series of moral problems, moral dilemmas, with the idea being that philosophers have long engaged in questions about their intuitions about what's right or wrong in a particular moral case, and my interest as a biologist is in whether the intuitions that drive a moral philosopher are generally shared or are the part of education and tutoring.
As a result of this research, Mark has identified three principles which lie behind our judgment of whether actions are forbidden, allowed, or obligatory.
The caveat here is that these are principles in a very kind of loose sense. And two of the principles, one we call basically the doctrine of double effect, it grows out of St. Thomas Aquinas, it's been well discussed in Catholicism and the law, is that harms that were intended as a means to a greater good will be perceived as worse than harms created as a side effect. The second principle also grows out of philosophy and law, which we call the action principle, and that is harms caused by action will be perceived as worse than harms caused by omission of action. And the third is what we call the contact principle, and this really grows much more out of social psychology than out of law or philosophy, and that is harm caused by personal contact with another will be perceived as worse than harm caused by non-contact. But the basic idea here is that we're looking for psychological distinctions that may push people's intuitions one way or the other. And as I kind of described in my book, Moral Mind, this is the notion of principle in a very, very loose way. And ultimately, we think is going to go on is there'll be much more abstract psychological concepts, much more like what we see in linguistics than what we currently articulating in moral philosophy and psychology.
These principles, however, are based on simple identifications. They do not have a particular emotional character. I asked Mark where emotions fit into this picture.
Most people assume that if it's not a rational, conscious, reflective process, that what's driving our judgments, the source of our judgments, are emotions. And where we've kind of come into the argument is say, look, emotions may play a role, but their role may be epiphenomenal or byproduct of the moral judgment. So it's perfectly possible, at least theoretically possible, that all of our computation that goes into making a decision about what's right or wrong intuitively is done without any emotion at all. Once the judgment's been made, that triggers an emotion that may influence our behavior and that may subsequently refine how we think about a certain moral problem.
It has been suggested, though, that without emotions, we cannot imagine ourselves in the future or even be curious, and without emotions, we'd be unable to reason effectively.
I think emotions play a crucial role in motivating rational, reasonable behavior, but they may not play a role in the guidance of judgment. So I could sit here right now and say, look, I think it's perfectly reasonable for me to go over and save the person in front of me who's about to fall, but will I do it? Well, maybe not, because maybe I don't like that person. So I may be motivated to do one thing, but I may judge it in a completely different way. So I think what's crucial in the work that we're doing, and crucial, I think, for the field, is that we distinguish the psychological processes that influence judgment, kind of in a cool, maybe calm state, as opposed to what happens in the here and now when you're actually forced to behave or respond to a particular situation. The example I like to give is one that happened several months ago in New York City, where a man was standing on the platform of a subway station with his two daughters, and a man next to him falls unconsciously onto the subway track. He sees the upcoming subway begin to move towards him. The man's unconscious. He leaps onto the subway track, reorients the man. The subway goes above both of their heads, and he saves the man, and nobody's hurt. Now, if you ask how many people would go do that, you'd probably find very few people who would go do that. If you ask how many people think it's permissible to save the man, everybody would say it's permissible to save the man. Is it obligatory? Absolutely not. Is it forbidden? Absolutely not. So you can get quite consistent consensus on the judgment level, but you would get huge amounts of variability in the doing because of people's attentional states, their motivational states, their emotions, and so forth.
Well, presumably this person had, some emotion of empathy or caring. Or
right there in the here and now. And if it had been the next day, he may not have done the same thing.
There's a lot to be learned from human beings, but there's also a lot to be learned from what primates are able to understand about intention.
Yeah, so the work we've been doing on non-human primates, both kind of captive primates and also primates in the wild, has the aim of trying to dissect some of the psychological ingredients or building blocks that may play into the evolution of our moral system. And so the basic idea has been, you might want to say, as some people in this conference have said, that non-human animals can't be moral agents because they can't be, or they are not aware of the extent to which their behavior can influence the behavior of others. They don't have any notion of what one ought to do. They just have a notion of what you do. And so as a result, they can't be moral agents. Okay, that may well be true, but what we can ask is, do non-human animals have some of the core building blocks that ultimately gave a foundation upon which humans evolved their own system? And so we can ask questions like the following. When human children develop into being moral agents, one of the stages they go through is they go beyond simply looking at the consequences of actions and looking at the means of those actions. So young children, if someone trips and hurts someone else, or someone actually punches someone else, those are perceived as the same because in the end the person got hurt. they then begin to realize that there's a difference between intending to hurt somebody and accidentally hurting somebody. So we've begun to look at questions like that, as have other people, beginning to show that animals have appreciation of the goals of an action, the intentions of underlying those goals, making a distinction between intended and accidental actions, and begun to look at questions like, do animals appreciate actions versus omissions and so forth.
And it seems as though at that point, Johnny August's neurology of ethics kind of ran out and he fell off the edge of a cliff. Well, no, he didn't actually. That was Johnny August talking to Dr. Mark Hauser from Harvard University on the neurology of ethics. If you like snorkeling in New South Wales marine estuaries like Jervis Bay, Wallace Lake or Port Stephens, you've probably swum over meadows of wafting seagrass. I'd like to have a closer look at this beautiful and important marine plant.
I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden.
The importance of seagrass with respect to many ecosystems cannot be stressed enough. Seagrass not only anchors sediment to the seabed, it also provides very effective nursery for all manner of baby animals, providing them with shelter and sustenance until they're big enough to survive on their own. It stabilizes the seabed, it stabilizes the shoreline, it clears up the water, it puts nutrients in the water, and it creates greater diversification in the habitat. However, seagrass stands out from other marine plants in a very profound way. Seagrass has flowers. Seagrasses are angiosperms, or flowering plants. They are not marine algae, like the various seaweeds you can see on rocky shores and beaches. Seagrasses are the only group of angiosperms to have returned to the sea after flowering plants evolved on the land, just like whales and dolphins after the evolution of mammals. Their life cycle is completed completely underwater, indicating complete reconquest of the ocean. Other angiosperms, such as the various mangrove species, have adapted to the intertidal area, but seagrasses are the only angiosperms to spend their entire lives completely immersed. There are two theories as to how seagrass evolved. One suggests that seagrass encroached on the marine habitat after coming to terms with the estuarine environment. The other states that the ancestors of seagrass lived in salt marsh, which was slowly flooded by a rising sea level, and that they adapted accordingly. Australia has an abundance of seagrasses, with 29 of the 57 described species occurring here. Let's have a look at one of them. A common species of seagrass found in New South Wales waters is Posidonia, commonly called strapweed because it looks like a bunch of floating green straps. Large beds of the stuff can be found as close by as Botany Bay. It doesn't like deep water, needing a lot of sunlight to grow. Its flowers are small, without petals, but still possess the basic structures of terrestrial flowers, including pollen sacs, stigmata, and modified leaves. The pollen is obviously different to terrestrial pollen, modified to float through the water until it lands on a stigma on another plant. Once there, fertilization follows just like on land, and the next generation arises. This all takes a long time, however. Seagrasses grow very slowly, and damaged meadows take forever to recover. These circles will take many years to grow over, and this is one of the great problems of the relationship between seagrass and humans. People have only just begun to realise the importance of this stuff after they have been destroying it wholesale. It's estimated that seagrass provides a nursery to 70%, yes, 7/10 of commercially caught fish. And so next time you tuck into a fillet of something, remember that fact. Seagrass has had various practical uses through history. It's an excellent thermal insulator and, due to its high silicon content, is highly non-flammable. It's been used to thatch roofs, stabilise sand dunes, as packaging material, fertiliser, been woven into baskets, just to name a few. Happily, all these things can now be made with other materials, and we can leave seagrass meadows alone to do the important work of raising baby fish. So, please protect seagrass meadows wherever you can. And if there are any masochists listening, please don't use strapweed as a whip. You'll not only be destroying an important natural resource, you'll probably get a nasty rash.
Below the storm, in our little hideaway beneath the waves, resting our head on the seabed, in an octopus's garden near a cave.
I'd like to be under the sea, in an octopus's garden, in the shade. Swim about the coral that lies beneath the waves. Oh, what joy for
every... Lachlan Watmore on guitar.
Thank you.
That was Chico O'Farrell with It's Ain't Necessarily So, and that's the end of this particular episode of Diffusion. If you'd like to have a look at us on the web, check out www.diffusionradio.com. If you'd like to email us, send through to diffusion@2ser.com. And Diffusion is broadcast right across the continent of Australia, coast to coast, on the Community Radio Network. This episode was produced by yours truly, Lachlan Watmore, and the good Mr. Ian Wolfe, who deserves plenty of credit for doing lots and lots of running around in the past, so let's hear it for the Wolfman. Yay! On the show, we've had Johnny August talking to Dr. Mark Hauser from Harvard University. I had a little bit of a chat about seagrass, and we had Patrick Ruby doing the news. That's all from this edition of Diffusion. Tune in next week when we'll have more sciencey goodness.